Well, I have to admit, I didn't start this fancy problem on my own. Husseini, 1991 in NASA, I guess, he and his competent buddies, Arle Barker, Sarkar, they were doing numerical simulation and they got me started on this. Well, I'm not doing simulation, by the way, though, but I looked at the analytical part of it. Bit by bit, I continued this work, and next I picked it up again in Nice when I happened to have a great time with Fish and Cocaine. And then Kyoto 1995 with Kida, and then Antonia gave me an opportunity to pursue this further 1997 in Australia, and Srini kindly got me here this spring, and I added one more bit for there. And I want to extend my debt to Dr. Kaitman, Oberoi, and Goto, and a whole bunch of them for giving me advice and tips and everything. Credit goes to them and blame goes to me. Okay, folks, get them all out. I'd like to make a few remarks on the spectral laws for the inertial ray, on the compressible case, and then make some remarks on the intermittency aspects in the compressible case. We'll focus mainly on the multifactorial type of formulation for the inertial ring and then extrapolate it down to the chromagraph macro scale, and then finally make a remark on a non-extensive statmic approach to this problem. Compressibility effects in turbulence. So one major effect is energy is continually radiated away in the form of sound waves. And this sound energy has to be, as Lightfield pointed out back in 1955 actually, sound energy has to be heat dissipated, the heat by the various processes of acoustic attenuation. So Mosiu, Petriashvili, and a whole bunch of people argued that compressive effects, that they act like an additional source of dissipation in the fluid in addition to the viscosity and thermal conductivity. But the nonlinear effects become important, become prominent, the sound waves steepen as everybody knows, to form shock waves, documented in the numerical simulation of Lee, Moyne, and Lele. Shock formation and shock interaction that comes in now leads to another source of energy dissipation, compressive effect turbulence. And numerical simulations have, as you expect, have documented vortices in the neighborhood of the shock waves. So the vortex formation behind the shock wave actually produces an anisotropic shear turbulence, what one might think. But here came Caronsev, the great guy of physical intuition from plasma physics. He said, despite the anisotropy caused by the individual shock, the random orientation of various shocks can then lead one to assume overall isotropy in a turbulent field. Now this interesting proposition of Caronsev was not isolated. He had done something similar. Let me quickly point out, he had done something similar for the case of atom in a magnetic field. Thomas Fermi said for the atom in a magnetic field, where atom sits in a strong magnetic field going that way. So what's going to happen? Electrons are going to go gyrating in non overlapping cylinders. So in the neighborhood of each electron, the charge distribution can never be spherically symmetric. But then Caronsev argued that if these cylinders are taken to be uniformly distributed in a big sphere, like typically this is an atom, like a uranium atom with a lot of electrons, and then the overall charge distribution can still be isotropic. So this led him to develop the first successful theory of atom in a magnetic field in the Thomas Fermi approach. So what I'm going to do is pursue further on that premise. So what I would like to point out is old stuff now, actually, 1992. Scale invariance arguments apply directly to Navier-Stokes equations in connection with a similar type of invariance condition on kinetic energy, similar to that of Kolmogorov did for the incompressible case, give a kind of a spectral law. Now here are the equations for the fluid in the barotropic assumption. So one makes a scaling transformation, x, speed, velocity. And these equations then turn out to be scale invariant if density, pressure, and viscosity scale like that. Now we make the Kolmogorov type of hypothesis, namely that the compressible beast is self-similar at small scales, so it possesses a unique scaling exponent. Of course, this is this is not true, is when there is intimate sense. And this immediately leads to the following scaling behavior for the energy, kinetic energy dissipation. Now if you assume that this guy is scale invariant, just like Kolmogorov did for the incompressible case, that means this whole thing has to go to zero. We immediately find alpha in terms of gamma. Gamma is the ratio of specific heats. So when gamma goes to infinity, you get Kolmogorov result. That's one third. I mean, that in this case is one. So the velocity and the density now scale like that. And this part I made a quick progress on that, and I came. So then I came onto the scaling behavior of the kinetic energy per unit volume. But then this does not exhibit. Yes, go ahead.
You don't have an exact relation like Kolmogorov relation in this case.
Hold it for a second. Hold on for a second. So well, this only exhibits the dependence of the kinetic energy on the scaling, but in the compressible case, as you all know, there should be a dependence on density, speed of sound. So they are not in here. So I struggled for 2 weeks in vain to find a way to bring them back in. I never got anywhere until one afternoon, it was NASA Langley. I had almost given up, and then I ran into this wonderful paper, Sankarov and Satyaki, on acoustic turbulence. And over there, they make this great observation that on dimensional grounds, the kinetic energy per unit volume actually should look like this. Now this is a very interesting proposition because in the incompressible case, when speed of sound is irrelevant, then that means it just has to be that, and that then this immediately gives you the Kolmogorov. So now when I combine this constraint with the one that I had deduced before, out pops the whole entourage: density, kinetic energy, dissipation, speed of sound. And then in the spectral picture. Now how does this compare with the other known guys in the extreme limits? In the zero compressibility limit, that's the Kolmogorov, gamma goes to infinity. In the ultimate compressibility limit, this is what Krackmann calls this, gamma going to 1, ultimate compressible limit. This is a Berger's factor minus 2. And then when you look at this exponent in here, you can break it down into a Kolmogorov part, but that's not the correction, that's an negative correction, so that means this is steeper. Now, there is intermittency, as you know, there is no such thing as non-intermittency, so. And here is a picture of Bouquet, co-workers. Now what I propose to do is adopt the Mandelbrot viewpoint for this intermittency, namely that it is related to the fractal aspects of the geometry. So let's assume that the dissipation is concentrated on a multifractal object, and as many of you know, multifractal is characterized by a measure defined in such a way that it has different fractal dimensions, different levels of the measure. And we make the generalized Frisch-Tarrasch type of hypothesis, namely that the compressible model is assumed to have a continuous spectrum of scaling exponents, alpha lying in that whole range continuously. For each alpha in this range, you've got a set there of fractal dimensions under that, such that velocity scales like that. Yes? And then this alpha min, alpha max, and function, the fractal dimension f, they are universal. Transition from a homogeneous fractal when alpha is only one value to this Frisch-Tarrasch type of multifractal is like going from Einstein's model for specific heat of solids to Debye model of specific heat of solids. We assume the dissipation field to be nested, to be composed of a nested set of singularities, like that, and then the p such function is given by that. And now this 3 minus f in here, if the exponent of 3 minus f of alpha is simply the probability to belong to that set at scale L. In the limit L going to 0, the dominant contribution here comes from the minimum value of this exponent in here, and that gotten from the steepest distance type of thing. So in terms of that, the characteristic exponent is given by all that. Now we need to find the relation between f and the generalized circle dimension. And for that, standard procedure, Puris and co-workers, right? We look at a coarse grain probability measure given by the energy dissipation occurring in a box of size L. It has a scaling property. And we divide the 3D space into boxes size L, some moments of this over all boxes. And if the dissipation field is a multifactorial, then these sums have to exhibit this scaling behavior. Boris is in here. Excuse me, Boris. There are five people in there. There are five people in there. So set it all out.
He tried to forget about it.
Yeah, he sounded that way. But there are still useful applications there. All right.
I don't believe.
So, what is that? And the dominant terms in that integral, in the limit of small l, can again be gotten by the steepest effect type of thing. So when we combine this with the one that we had seen previously, the characteristic exponent given in terms of the generalized circle dimension. Okay. Well, now how do you find it? How do you find the expression for G and D? One way to do that, I recently noticed, to use inextensive stat mech. It is useful formula that is coming with a non-extensive stat mech for this. And for that, we need to get going with a non-extensive stat mech that studies some of formalism. We need to identify a proper state energy for the compressible case. And then we proceed by recognizing that velocity and density scale like that. So that means the density scales in terms of velocity like that. So the energy, kinetic energy per unit column, which is given by that, and scales like that, unsuitably redefined indeed. So then we take for the velocity the following PDF, which is appropriate for the canonical ensemble in Salis's prescription, given by all that. Q is the so-called non-extensivity parameter. So when Q goes to 1, non-extensivity disappears. And data time is like a 1 over temperature. And then this is a partition function. Now when we evaluate that partition function integral, we get that horrendous thing there. But interesting thing is, when Q goes to 1, that PDF goes into this Boltzmann-Gibbs type of thing. And then when you take the zero compressibility limit, that goes to the usual. That goes to the usual formalism. And here is how pictorially those PDFs look like. This is incompressible case Gaussian, and that's a compressible. The interesting thing is to observe that the incompressible case has an extended tail compared with the compressible cutoff.
Are you talking about the density, or which field is that now?
Velocity.
Velocity. Modulus of the velocity or what?
This is the modulus of velocity. PDF for the modulus of velocity.
What would you phrase for the PDF of the density?
Oh, I haven't calculated that. This is modulus of velocity. Just for an idea. And when we...
Then a Mach number, right?
There's no explicit Mach number. I got a gamma as a compressibility parameter. So you can actually write it in terms of Mach number, ultimately.
Gamma be...
Ratio of circuits.
Yeah, right. But then you still have the Mach number.
Well, somewhere it will come in terms of that. But I have not explicitly identified that. Okay. Now, when one goes through the type of calculation that, like, Christian Beck outlined here a few weeks ago, for the compressible case, we get this horrendous expression for the structure function exponent. The interesting thing is, when Q goes to 1, intermittency reactions disappear and we get initial drain results. And this still is not very familiar to most of you, so you take the zero compressibility limit, that's Kolmogorov vector. So the deviation of Q from 1 is taken to characterize the degree of spatial intermittency.
The probability distribution that you had in the previous life, can it be compared to a simulation?
Could be. I have not done that. I said that we're going to bring in that non-extensive stat make to find an expression for GFD, and here we have it. This is the multifactor result for the stress function exponent, and we compare that to the one that we had from non-extensive stat make and immediately have an expression for the GFD in terms of Q. So when Q goes to 1, these logs drop out and becomes equal to 3. And in the limit of Q close to 1, all that mess simplifies into this simple situation. And you get the zero compressibility limit, that's the incompressible result. And here is a picture of how these two guys look like. So you've got a bunch of two parabolas. The interesting thing is to observe that the compressor one is out, one outside, incompressible one is one inside. So the compressible guy is always closer to 3 than the incompressible guy. So much for the discussion in the inertial range. Let's extrapolate this to the Kolmogorov macroscale, and then in the process also extend discussion to turbulence in hyperspace.
D-dimensional.
Yes. Well, actually,
so
I have
one within.
Yeah. Well.
There should be something on the
test. What I assumed is that the variance is equal to 1 for both cases. The variance is equal to 1. Okay. Let's go from that. Let's extrapolate this to the macro scale and extend the story to D dimensions. It leads to a little bit wild situation. Okay, now, taking into account the intermittency of the dissipation field, the Kolmogorov macro scale itself exhibits fluctuations, and then this leads to the following scaling of the macro scale with this scaling exponent alpha, where R hat is the mean Reynolds number. So this is the main basic thing on this, and then I will proceed to work with that. The number of degrees of freedom given by Landau-Lipschitz in D dimensions is that, and in terms of Reynolds number, that, no intermittence. So what we want to do now is estimate this now by putting in intermittency. For that purpose, what we do, we assume dissipation is constant on a multifactor, and this, then multifactor scaling can be extrapolated down to the macro scale. Whole bunch of people made a beginning with this. Mark Necklin, co-workers, and Massimo, right here. Right? Massimo and Fish. Right. So degrees of freedom. We know the scaling of eta now in the macro scale range and put it back in here, so it goes like that. And then we estimate the dominant terms in this integral the usual way, and here comes the final result. N goes like that. But Q is now... This
Q little, is not what is used to be the degree of freedom.
Sorry, I apologize. That next thing is gone. It was only a brief interlude.
So what is Q?
Q is this Q.
And it is given implicitly by this funny thing. Now, the interesting thing is not worry about how exactly dq related to q, but recognize that this thing can be rewritten like that. So you have a transition dimension at d equal to 4. So when d is less than 4, q is less than d over 4. When d is greater than 4, q is greater than d over 4. That means the Landau estimate puts a reduction in the Landau estimate for d less than 4, and then enhancement for d greater than 4. Well, for d less than 4, the degree of freedom going down is obvious to everybody because you have coherent structures, and they're going to bring the degree of freedom down. But in the hyperspace, it goes up. Now, why does it go up?
So what is it exactly for d equals 3?
D equal to 3, just plug it in.
Yeah, I'm asking what it is.
Just plug it in.
What is the number? It's 3
cubed. It is some number with the intermittency correction. It's some number with intermittency correction.
I would like to know how useful it is for me, if I'm going to the simulations. I know you use Landau estimate. I know that I'm in three dimensions.
Yeah.
That's one thing I know.
Yeah.
And now I would like to know what is your estimate here.
Yeah, put D equal to 3 right here and it.
What is the number?
I can give you the number.
In general, if you have to think this is Landau and something new,
all right,
choose Landau.
Well, it is, hey. Right. This quantity Q in here has an interesting structure. See how nicely this guy looks in the D less than 4, and it gets completely weird. So hyperspace, the hyperspace is filled with pathological creatures. Now the interesting thing about, let me make something else about, we saw this transition dimension at D equal to 4. The interesting thing was, this was actually established also for the incompressible case by Kreitman. So what that means is this result is pretty robust. And it doesn't change for incompressible.
The nature of D equal to 4 is a boundary.
Transition.
And so actually, Kreitman argued for this incompressible.
Actually, as those of you who do condensed matter know, D equal to 4 is also transition dimensionality, critical phenomenon. Uh-huh. Ferromagnetism. So there is a lot of universality, apparently. Let's proceed to the story. Macro scale. Take a look at the moments of velocity gradient. And they have this expression. And let's evaluate this again, same old way. And here we obtain the scaling behavior of feet moment of velocity gradient. We got this fancy expression over there. Once again, he's going into this. Alright, the interesting thing here is feel a little bit puzzled by the quantitative detail, but look at the qualitative picture. Alright. Now what we are interested most is A2, obviously because of energy dissipation. So put P equal to 2 here, so then that goes like that. Alright. As a matter of fact, when P equal to 2, and then gamma goes to infinity, what we had is 1 plus 1 is 2, and that's a 2 plus 2 times 2 is a 4, B plus 4D, D plus 4D, they cancel, and Q will be equal to 1. And then that means the corresponding fractal dimension we're talking about is D1, which is entropy dimension. So dissipation, is connected with entropy dimension, as you anticipate. So for the incompressible case, the picture is real solid. All right. Now let us take a look at what happens to the energy dissipation. Which now we know the scaling behavior of that from the previous one, so put it back in here, so for that. Now what this tells us is that, unlike the incompressible situation, the compressible guy is not independent of viscosity when viscosity goes to 0. So that university dissipation of energy is not a valid concept in the compressible.
This is rather counterintuitive, because if I consider a single shock, then on a single shock...
Let's come to that. I'll hold off the remark.
Burgers,
yeah, there is Burgers turbulence coming in. It just a couple of minutes. Just hold off. Couple of minutes. And now, I just wanted to point out that even the velocity gradient moment exhibits a transition dimensionality at t equal to 4. Because this is the exponent of the AP over there, and you can rewrite that as that plus that, and you see its transition P minus 4. But that happens only when this guy in here is not equal to 0, this guy here.
Shouldn't you define energy dissipation in a different way and account compressive
of this rho term? You've seen there, epsilon has density in there. It's
how do you define dissipation? How do you define dissipation?
It's a rho, no, it's a mu times dv over dx to the power of 2.
Per unit volume, per unit mass.
Per unit mass. So this transition happens only when P is greater than P star. P star is given by that. But the interesting thing is, when P equal to P star, transition dimensionally disappears in hyperspace. But P star is the value. P star takes the value equal to 2. In the incompressible limit. So what that means is the inviscid dissipation happens for the incompressible case, as you all know, but then it happens it happens to be a special event. Why? Because when that happens, you have a loss of transition dimensionality at t equal to 4 for the corresponding retrograde moment. So it's a very special event, even when it happens in the incompressible case. Let me know Burgers. Let's see how Burgers comes into the picture with this. Cracknell calls this ultimate compressibility limit. And it turns out from the multifactor formulation that I showed you for the general case, and if you specialize it to d equal to 1, this is what you get for the characteristic exponent over there. The interesting thing is to observe, it doesn't grow with p. Number two, since you got shocks, d not equal to 0, theta p is equal to 1, that gives rise to k to the power minus 2 right there. Now if you extrapolate this, the multifactor scaling that we saw just a few seconds ago, down to the Kolmogorov scale for the Burgers setting, the velocity gradient moments in the scale like that, and even take a look at t equal to 2, we're building up towards energy dissipation. So A2 goes like that. And then if you have, for the Burgers model, you've got shock, so dq goes to 0. So you've got a 3 times 1 over 3, which is 1, and this A2 goes like R. R is nu to the power minus 1. So you multiply that by nu, you've got a constant. So that means this guy here is one thing independent of nu, as nu goes to 0 in the other extreme. So I guess basically I'm ready to close. All right. With the following remarks, namely, inviscid dissipation is a feature that occurs only either in zero compressibility limit or infinite compressibility limit, but doesn't happen in the general compressibility. More interestingly, even when this happens for the zero compressibility case, this happens by being constrained on some remarkable properties of turbulence dynamics at the macro scale in the hyperspace, because you have loss of transition dimensionality. Well, consideration of dynamics in hyperspace in order to obtain some insights into the corresponding story in the 3D case is an old game, due to goes back to Kaluza 1921. Kaluza considered he considered generalization of Einstein's general relativity from 4D space-time to 5D hyperspace to achieve unification of gravitation and electromagnetism. I will at the end with a small story about Kaluza, though. Leave only 1 minute. Kaluza, as many of you know, he was a modern day Niels Abel. He was living in very impoverished conditions in Poland. People living in impoverished conditions, they always look to people well set like Gauss or Einstein. Like Bose communicated his result to Einstein, as you all know. He was living in similar conditions in Bengal, India, you know. So Kaluza communicated his results to Einstein to get a quick recognition of his potential. But unfortunately, Einstein kept his manuscript away and then didn't see it for years. Didn't bring it out for years. But when it was rediscovered and then came out, Kaluza couldn't sustain that financial hardship during the intervening years, and unfortunately he had quit physics and something like that. So the lesson from this story, when I heard this story from Abdul Salam, was that if you're a young guy and you think you have done a great work, and you don't make the mistake of communicating it to a great guy, you do rather well publishing it yourself and then let great guys find out. Well, I won't advocate you do it. Thank you, folks.
First of all, thank you very much for being so respectful of the amount of time. But the business of dissipation not being constant, and the definition of dissipation, so I got confused because there was supposed to be dissipation due to acoustic waves. And where did that come?
I did not quite look at that. I only looked at viscous dissipation.
And to arrive at that result is the consequence of some other assumption. For Komagorov, it is an assumption. So here, I suppose you could have assumed that as well, except for you must have assumed something else.
The sounder activity, they essentially went into the invariance conditions on the energy dissipation. They got modified. And after that, I never go back and look at what sounders are doing.
Yeah. Okay. No, but, let's just look at this anticipation.
Yeah.
So Komagorov would assume that that's been fixed, whereas you must have assumed something else instead.
Oh, I
was trying to understand what exactly that alternative assumption is.
I only assume that epsilon is a all that, and that is scaling very, and density is a dynamical variable. So I only assume, imitating Kolmogorov, that this is a scale invariant quantity. You know what I mean? That's the basic condition I put before I erected this whole structure. So everything is contingent on the validity of that assumption. I only imitated that. I will try to take care of.
So therefore, the answer is that it's non viscous dissipation that picked up that. Okay.
Can I ask you also my question about Kolmogorov Fourtiev's law for this year?
Oh,
Fourtiev's law.
Oh, you mean the counterpart of that?
Uh-huh.
Oh, that transition or something like a. Something like that. Something like that.
There is exact analog of this law in here, not proportionality, but just coefficients.
Actually,
it's
the whole.
Exact law.
You got the whole. You got, like I mentioned, you got the whole story there. Unfortunately, I don't have one for the compressor, for obvious reasons, because
the pressure doesn't drop out.
The development is not, I haven't done it yet. But to establish the dynamical basis of this guy, that connection got to be made. So basically, folks, like I mentioned, these are all things in the clouds here. Yes.
We have a paper in Physical Letters, KIDA, and we looked into this problem in the limit of very high Mach number and we included it in simulations. KIDA was there. So what we found was that the 5/3 stays 5/3. The Mach number reaches 1 over square root of 3. And what happens there, the turbulence is basically and because of the normalization of the speed of sound. So speed of sound becomes self-dependent and computed a small volume, larger and larger volumes, speed of sound changes. And that's why this enables the finite Mach number,
and
we weren't able to detect any deviations from, so the only thing which we had was that the rotational turbulence was driving the shocks and so on.
I grant that, yeah, I agree.
We didn't see any corrections to 5/3.
This is just like the story for the MHC turbulence, where Crichton came up with the case of Kirchhoff minus 3/2, you know? Yeah, but just like the MHD case, these corrections may be too small.
What about transition from inverse to direct? Is there any
inverse
case in this
compressor? There is no, unfortunately, yeah, they don't have the entropy constraint, all that, for the 2D compressible case.
Okay.
2D compressible thing probably is not different from 3D compressible. Just like the MHD case is basically.
Yes, so there is no expectation of inverse cascade.
No, I wouldn't imagine. Yeah.
At all?
I wouldn't imagine. Because your vorticity generation due to the baroclinic effects. Thank you, Boris. Thank you, everybody.
And my next speaker is Leslie.
Work done in collaboration with Fabian. And also when we were doing the work on rotation, I had the lots of discussions with Victor Yakot, who's also here. And he has a slightly different point of view on all of this, which I'll only be able to mention for lack of time, but since he's here, he can perhaps tell you about that afterwards. So the point is this. We know that in geophysical flows, horizontal length scales are much greater than vertical length scales. So it's tempting to try to discard things with 2D, but we also know that many times 3D mechanisms are very important. On the other hand, energy is observed to be transferred from fast small scales to slow large scale motions, a backward transfer, which also smells of 2D, but I would venture to say that in most cases, it is not as simple as a 2D inverse cascade. And so the question is, can we understand this energy transfer from small scales to large scales in a fully 3D flow? So let me remind you of sort of a hierarchy of models that's used for geophysical flows, starting with the beta plane model, which is 2D but has Rossby waves, rotating shallow water flows that have surface gravity waves, rotating flows where we have inertial waves, stratified flows which have internal gravity waves, and then rotating stratified flows which have inertial gravity waves.
And you're talking above, below point two, everything is 3D.
Everything is 3D, yeah.
Well, shallow
water. Well, it's 2.5 maybe you would call it. yeah. So I guess really what you'd like to work up to is rotating stratified flows on a sphere where you have both Rossby waves and inertial gravity waves. So the point is that all these flows have dispersive waves and turbulence. And you can say a few general things about all of them, and these statements will hopefully become more clear as we go along. First of all, the dispersive wave motions tend to reduce the transfer of energy that would be achieved by the turbulence alone. However, there are resonant interactions that are not affected by the dispersion, so where the nonlinearity remains strong. And this is an important fact. In a resonant triad interaction between two fast waves and a slow mode, the coefficient of the slow mode vanishes identically. So a slow mode is defined to be one where the frequency is zero, and the point is, for resonant triad interactions, you cannot put energy into the slow modes by way of the fast modes.
Directly, right.
And so this result follows from lowest order and weak turbulence expansion, and it's been shown for all these flows that I mentioned, all these models. These are the references. I'll just point to in rotating flow, the result goes back to Greenspan. And was shown in a general geometry, and then up to rotating stratified flows. There's some nice work by Bartello and Maida and MD. Okay, so why is this important? It's important because it justifies using simplified models involving only the slow modes for relatively short time scales on the order of a few eddy turnover times, i.e. fuzz geostrophic models. And so the question that we are asking is, what happens on longer time scales? Can you have coupling between the slow large scale motions and the fast small scale motions? And can it be important for some physical phenomena? And it's clear that this coupling would appear at higher order in a weak turbulence expansion. So it would arise from things like quartet interactions. Okay, so I want to talk about 3D rotating flow and 2D stratified flow. This is a nice sort of test case, and some things are easier to visualize in 2D, so I'd like to show you some things about 2D. Stratified flow. I probably will not have very much time to talk about 3D stratified flow, rotating stratified flow. I will show you a few plots, hopefully. Here we're following the work of Karim and Matei, who did some simulations of 3D stratified flow using a two-dimensional force, and we're going to extend that to using a three-dimensional force. So I'm going to be talking about forced turbulence here. And in rotating stratified flow, there have been some simulations by Matei et al. In 64 cubes, where they say that they observe a minus 5/3 scaling for the region where you have transfer of energy from small to large scales, but they show only plots for the case 2 omega equals n, which is a very special case because there are no resonant triads in this case. And what I find is that if you go away from this this case 2 omega equals n, then you find something quite different from minus 5/3. Actually, I don't really think it makes much sense to talk about scalings in these low resolution simulations in any case, but it's clearly not 5/3 when you go away from 2 omega equals n. Okay, so let's talk about the case of rotating flow first. So these are the Navier-Stokes equations in a rotating frame. In the inviscid and linear limit, we have inertial wave solutions. Here's the dispersion relation. So the frequency is plus or minus 2 omega kz over k. The s is the plus or minus. So there's a wave traveling in the direction of k and one in opposite to the direction of k. If you just had the Coriolis term by itself, you would have the velocity vector counter-rotating about the rotation axis. But it has to do that always in a plane perpendicular to k to satisfy incompressibility. So that's what happens. This velocity vector will rotate, counter-rotate about omega in a plane perpendicular to k. Okay, so those are the inertial waves. So you can go even further and look for time-independent solutions in this linear and viscid limit. So you just have the balance between the Coriolis term and the pressure. It's just a couple of lines to show that time-independent solutions are 2D, okay, in this linear and viscid limit. 2D meaning only in the plane perpendicular to the rotation axis, which I always take to be Z. And these are the slow modes, okay, because the frequency here is proportional to KZ over K, right? So KZ equals zero are the slow modes, and these are the 2D modes, okay? So the slow modes are in this limit. But this is a very restricted statement, has nothing to do particularly with the turbulent case. Okay, the fully nonlinear turbulent case. Okay, so let's go further and look at the full nonlinear equations and write the velocity as a superposition of these inertial waves. You can then write the equations for the amplitudes of these waves, the b's in Fourier space. Here it is. Okay, it looks, has exactly the same form as the non-rotating Navier-Stokes equations in Fourier space with a different CKPQ, a different coefficient, and then this extra phase factor that multiplies the nonlinear term. Okay? Everybody happy with that?
So these waves are Rossby waves?
No.
Inertial.
Oh, the inertial waves, right. Okay. But they're coming from the rotation term?
Yes.
And
if you non-dimensionalize then by some nonlinear time scale, like the maximum vorticity, 1 over the maximum vorticity, then the space factor has a 1 over the Rossby number here, and it's clear that the nonlinear interactions are dephased on a time scale of the order of the Rossby number, unless the resonance conditions are satisfied, namely that the sum of these frequencies adds up to 0, so the phase factor is 1, plus you always have the sum of the wave vectors adding up to 0. So these are the resonance conditions, and the Rossby number is the ratio of the nonlinear time scale to the rotation time scale. Okay, so if it wasn't clear before what the resonant triad interactions are, I hope it is now. This is the definition of the resonant triad interaction. Okay, so I'll repeat those statements that I made at the beginning, because now they should be more clear. So we have, in general, that the dispersive wave motions reduce the energy transfer. However, for resonant triad interactions, it's not reduced. So you might expect these resonant triad interactions to play an important role. Okay? And also, you cannot transfer energy from two 3D modes to a 2D mode, that is with KV equals 0 in the horizontal, a mode with wave vector in the horizontal plane. And that's just because the CKPQ, the coefficient of that slow mode, vanishes. Okay? And it's just a bit of algebra to show that. Once you know what CKPQ is, you use the resonance conditions and you show that CKPQ vanishes. Okay, so on the one hand, you see you have the Taylor-Proudman theorem, which says that slow, in this time-independent regime, linear and viscid, you have 2D solutions. And this has led a lot of researchers to look for 2D solutions in the nonlinear regime, such as Cambon and his co-workers in France. Usually they did this they used decaying simulations with real viscosity, and they saw trends toward two-dimensionality, but it's sort of hard to say anything definitive because very quickly things become viscous and dominated by viscous decay. And so it wasn't entirely clear that things two-dimensionalized in the nonlinear regime. The Reynolds numbers are low. On the other hand, you have this result saying that that direct resonant triad interactions cannot transfer energy into the 2D modes. Okay, so there's sort of a question there. And so we did some forced simulations with hyperviscosity. Okay, so I don't want the Reynolds number to be a parameter in my simulations anymore. So I'm using hyperviscosity and forcing at a relatively small wave number, just the white noise forcing. Okay. Here's a typical plot that you get if you do such a simulation. So this is a 128 cubed simulation here. Here's the force. It's peaked around wave number 24. What else do we need to know here? Okay, well, the two plots that you see are the solid line is the full energy spectrum, and the dashed line is the energy that's in the 2D plane. So it's the energy as a function of the horizontal wave number only, where KZ is equal to 0. Okay, so this Rossby number is 0.17. I should have said that all of my Rossby numbers in these simulations are between about 0.1 and 0.5, so I would say they are intermediate Rossby numbers, small enough that maybe weak turbulence should apply, but not the limit of Rossby number going to 0. Okay, so you can clearly see that there's transfer of energy to the large scale. And all of the energy that's sitting in the large scale is in the 2D plane, is in the horizontal plane, is in the slow mode. Okay? Down here at the small scales, you have fully 3D stuff. Okay? So clearly, even in the nonlinear regime, you get strong two-dimensionalization.
Shouldn't you actually expect the minus 5/3 in the inverse path?
Well, okay, this is the next view graph. I don't know whether you should expect it or not. I put a minus 3 through this. Okay, I'm not really 100% convinced that this is actually a minus 3. I think it's steeper than minus 5/3. You would get a minus 3 just on dimensional grounds if you just assume that omega and k are the only relevant parameters.
Yeah, but you inject energy, right? So epsilon is not just a command.
No, but it's interacting with the rotation.
So
that's just the k.
Well, I mean, the point is that you could, there are more dimensional parameters now. You could form some scalings, including epsilon. They would be different than minus 3. Okay, so it's not clear that this should happen, but it looks...
Look at my scale down.
Do I have large scaling? No. No, these are all time developing and single realization that I showed you. So no large scaling.
What you were asked was that if you double the pumping rate, your energy doesn't change.
The whole level rises up.
Look at the formula, how it will rise. There's no pumping here.
I agree, there's no pumping here.
So how can it rise?
So you want to scratch this? I mean, so you're saying epsilon has to appear?
Yeah.
Okay, fine.
That's could be looked at as a saturation spectrum. Waves break when the amplitude gets high enough, and you can make arguments of that sort that will lead to this as a saturation spectrum analogous to those that are seen for water waves.
Yeah,
it's
like universal Phoenix or something.
Okay.
You're injecting.
But energy. I understand the point. Yeah.
You're injecting energy at scale epsilon. I mean, you're injecting energy at S equals 24 at a rate constant rate epsilon.
Yes. And epsilon is 1.
Okay,
I mean, I take it to be, yeah.
What is your dissipation rate? Is that epsilon?
It is smaller, because clearly all of the energy is not being dissipated by the small scale. Yeah,
but how much is going which way?
Okay, so that is a function of Rossby number. As you lower the Rossby number below some critical value, I should have said this too. So there's a critical value of order 1. If the Rossby number is larger than this critical value, which is of order 1, then you don't have any transfer from small to large scales. It's all dissipated, okay? And then you start decreasing the Rossby number below this critical value, and more energy is transferred to large scales. So the energy dissipation rate depends on the Rossby number.
And what's the rate of increase of energy? I mean, there's no dissipation mechanism at the large scale.
That's right. So you can only do this, you can only run these simulations.
What is saturated?
What is sure? I mean,
that,
so...
And what Chuck just said then would make sense, that what you've developed is a saturation spectrum.
Okay, fine.
So that's why epsilon doesn't come into it, possibly.
Yeah, and you don't agree? It's possible. I mean, in fact, you actually see the slope increasing, I would say, a little bit... towards the end of the simulation.
Right.
So it's sort of this is sort of asymptotic in a sense, yeah.
Unfortunately, the S3P cascade rate in the real atmosphere turns out to be about 1 per day heat, and which is comparable to the omega interventions, which is essentially 1 per day.
What do you imply?
It's hard to separate an argument based on entropy cascade rate in the real atmosphere. On one hand.
Are you saying to explain this minus 3? The minus 3 in the atmosphere?
Yeah.
Well, I'm not trying to do that.
No, all right.
Yeah. No, yeah, okay. Yeah.
The minus 3 is observed.
That's right, it is. But I'm not necessarily trying to explain that.
And what about small scale? So it seems that we have another.
Yeah. Okay. There isn't really enough range. I did look at it. I didn't bring the plots with me. Just for fun, I did, I put lines through them and plotted compensated spectra in the small scale, too. For Rossby numbers below critical but not too far below critical, things seem to scale as minus 5/3. But then when you go lower in Rossby number, it becomes a minus 2 as the best I can fit. Again, for moderate, I didn't go very much below 0.1 for Rossby number. So something else may happen, and it's just a fit for, let's say, 10 wave numbers or something.
I understand you correctly that you do actually get a stationary spectrum at that late times?
No, I stopped the simulation.
Okay.
Because...
She starts getting steeper.
Yes.
Yeah, but to check the statement about dependence on the flux, you might introduce a bit artificial...
Yeah, I mean, that's not really, the spectra, it wasn't really my question to begin with, the scaling of the spectrum, so I didn't pursue it that much. It's really the fact that you get transfer at all to the large scales, and then the fact that it's in the 2D plane, it's all in the slow modes, okay? So that was the original spot. Okay, so let me just show you a picture in real space. So these are, this is three Z planes lying on top of each other at these locations. And you have cyclonic vortices here, and clearly things are fairly 2D. Okay, because this is three Z planes on top of each other. Okay. So we have to explain this this nonlinear two-dimensionalization. We know that it can't come from direct resonant triad interactions. So here are some possible higher-order mechanisms for transfer of energy to the slow 2D mode. The ones I wrote down here are all based on resonant triads. Okay, this is not the only thing you can do. You could have transfer from purely non-resonant quartets, for example, and that's what Victor's theory was based on. Okay, but these are some here are some that are actually based on resonant triads. Okay, the first is, of course, you could just relax. You should relax the resonance condition in practice to be order Rossby, and that gives you a coefficient which is non-zero but small of the order Rossby. This one, actually, we have some nice evidence that this is playing a role, and it's easiest to see in the case of 2D stratified, so I'll show you some plots in 2D stratified. And Fabian showed a while back that you can get transfer of energy towards the horizontal plane with resonant triad interactions, not exactly into the horizontal plane, but once you have transfer almost in the 2D plane, then these nearly 2D modes can transfer energy into exactly 2D modes, okay? And we have some evidence that this may be playing a role. And then Newell defined some resonant quartet interactions built upon resonant triads, and you can find the analogous things for rotating flow, and these also may be playing a role. So those are some possibilities, and I'll show you some evidence for the second one. Okay. So now I would like to go on to the case of 2D stratified flow. I'm going to look at the 2D, is it, okay? So it's 2D flow in the Boussinesq approximation. I won't show equations unless somebody really wants to see them. Okay. Again, we have an anisotropic dispersion relation. Here it is, plus or minus N, Kx over K. N is the Brunt-Weissel frequency. B is the stratification parameter, which is positive for stable stratification. And now I have the Froude number is the relevant non-dimensional parameter. And large Froude numbers means weak stratification, small Froude numbers means strong stratification. Again, you can look at look for steady solutions in the linear and viscid limit. It basically follows right from the dispersion relation. If you have the wave frequency much, much smaller than the Brunt-Weissel frequency, then this implies that Kx is much, much smaller than Kz. So in this limit, you have horizontal layering. Okay? And then also, you can do the weakly nonlinear analysis, which will show you this decoupling between the fast and slow modes for resonant triad interactions. And we want to ask what happens on longer timescales. So the decoupling would be for timescales of the order of 1 over the Froude number, and we're asking about longer timescales. Okay, so here's a plot of kinetic energy versus time for a fixed resolution. It's 512 squared. The forcing wave number is 96. The energy input rate is again 1. And I'm varying on this plot the Froude number starting from infinity, which is no stratification. So here we have just 2D isotropic flow. In this case, you get growth of the kinetic energy in time, which is linear. This is the 2D inverse cascade. Okay. So now you turn down the Froude number, and you have a gradual reduction of the growth of the kinetic energy. So somehow the 2D to 2D transfer is being turned off as you increase the stratification until eventually when you get to Froude number about 1, it's completely turned off. You get no transfer of energy to the large scales. Okay? And then you can continue increasing the stratification and find that again you get transfer of energy to the large scales, but now it's a 2D to 1D transfer. Okay? And so this is the region that I'm most interested in. Below critical, and it makes sense, of course, that the critical value should be 1, where stratification and nonlinear effects are comparable. So here's just a sketch of what I'm doing in the simulation. I'm putting energy in at some wave number, kf, in a circle, and for the region of Froude number less than 1, we'll see energy pile up on the kx equals 0 axis. So I'll just show one spectrum, and then I'll show you the real space plot. So here I have two energy spectra plotted. One is the full energy spectrum, and then the energy of kx equals 0 kz. You see that they lie right on top of each other for large scales, so everything is 1D, and at small scales, things are still 2D. The real space picture looks like layers. Okay. So in the nonlinear regime, we still have strong layering. And now I want to show you this mechanism, which is analogous to the one I discussed in rotation, where you have transfer to nearly 1D modes by the direct resonant triad interactions, and then followed by transfer from nearly 1D modes into exactly 1D modes. To do this, I force a single K, okay, happens to be this one, 8040. You can ask, what are all the T's and Q's that are resonant in this K? That gives you a curve, which we call the resonant traces. And then you can ask, well, does the energy lie near those, away from those, where does it lie? Okay. So here's a plot of that. So this is an early time in a simulation where I'm forcing that single mode, the lines of the resonant traces. And you can see that for early times, clearly you do have the energy, these are contours of energy, you do have the energy sort of piling up along these resonant traces. And then later in time, you look a little later in time, and things are no longer everywhere. It's just piled up on the kx equals 0 axis. Okay, so that's some evidence that there's this two-step process which involves the resonant triads. I will just now show one plot from the case of rotating stratified, just to make a couple of points. Okay, so this is a 128 cube simulation where the rotation rate is 5, the n is 40. So the relevant thing you want to look at is 2 omega over n. So 2 omega over n here is 1 quarter. Okay, so we're not anywhere near the case 2 omega equals n where there are no resonant triads. I wanted to stay away from that. The first thing you see, so this is the top curve here is the full energy spectrum. First thing you see is that there is energy transfer to large scales. I wanted to make this point because there are a lot of experts in the field who didn't think that in the case of rotating stratified flow that you would get energy transfer from small to large scales. Okay, you clearly do. Second thing is to show that there really is no minus 5/3 here. I don't really think it makes sense to put lines through these spectra, but I did some best fits for different regions just for the fun of it, and here you get minus 1.334, and here you get, if you try to do it down here, you get minus 0.31, and it doesn't really make too much sense. But anyway, I don't believe it's a minus 5/3. You can also see, so the crosses here are the energy in the horizontal plane, and the dashes are the energy in the along, what, kz equals 0. So this corresponds to layering, and this corresponds to some sort of two-dimensionalization. You can see that really layering is not significant anymore for this ratio equal a quarter. Perhaps some sort of two-dimensionalization is going on here. What you really want to do, of course, is define the zero modes for this flow and see if energy is all in the zero modes here. It's much more complicated to do this because there are zero modes for every wave vector in rotating stratified flow, but clearly that's what we need to do to see if this whole scenario is kind of universal. I believe it is, but it has to be done. And so I'll just put up a conclusion slide here. So strong two-dimensionalization in rotation and one-dimensionalization in stratification, which is corresponds to population with zero modes. There is transfer to large scales in rotating stratified flow. You need to show that it's the zero modes that are dominating in rotating stratified flow. And then some questions here. We need to further figure out what role the resonant triads are playing, if any. and you can ask, well, what do we do about weak turbulence theory, which probably cannot capture any of these effects? And then, what about large eddy simulation models, which I would venture to say at this point probably cannot capture any of these effects either. Thank you.
The only query I have is, so stratification and rotation, we are not doing the same thing, they are doing different things. You got a two translation in the case of rotation and...
That's right.
No, but they're not the same things.
No, but I mean, they provide a rotation if you want.
Yeah.
Dispersion relation, you know, when you have a sign, then you have a sign.
Yeah.
What about intermittent in all those inverse cascades which you have? Do you have any no intermittency?
Well, I mean, I can say that there are structures here. Right, so I'm not quite sure how you want to think about it. I didn't measure them. I can easily do it. I would say that there probably is, but I don't know if I've measured them.
Probably.
Yes. Would you agree?
How would I know? Yeah.
Well, there are structures, right?
So, I think you have to keep in mind these are only 128 cubic calculations, and she's splitting her spectrum into two halves, so there's not much you can do with that.
Another question, I'm not quite sure I understand why I was saying that the weak turbulence kind of explains all this.
Well, I had a discussion with Wally about this yesterday. At some point, you end up introducing timescales, which are sort of model timescales. And you probably can't get this kind of effect unless you go to all orders. Maybe you can, but you know, if you truncate, these coherent structures are probably, you have to sum to all orders.
Yeah, but it's not clear whether the role of the coherent structures on the exponent or on the scaling sugar.
It's clearly large, right? I mean, if you don't have these structures, why would you have the same spectrum? And why would you care, anyway? I mean, the same spectrum, you can have the same spectrum for two different flows, and what does it mean? And you want to capture the structures. A spectra, I don't think, is really...
So your point is structures, right?
I think that's the important issue.
Your last comment about LES, that's based on the fact that LES are basically dissipated, so we don't expect that you can predict these effects, yes? So that would suggest that some non-dissipative models need to be developed. And the second question is, if I think that it's possible to develop such models, the question is, the energy transfer from small to large scales, could you estimate how local or non-local it is, where the energy from small scales is going, actually, directly to very large scale, so it goes through some sort of still cascade process? Because that implies different things for turbulence.
Yeah, it does. I'll just put up one thought for the case of 3D stratification where you don't get any scaling at all. I don't know if this will help or not. I'm not sure I can really answer your question, but the 3D stratified, it looks like there's really some kind of resonance going on. Okay, so where's my force? So here's my force, and you're getting pileup of energy in these clearly, you know, two distinct wave numbers. This is 3D stratified. Okay, so it looks to me like it's not necessarily a local process, at least for this case. I can't say too much, but yeah. And the thing about LES is, so you have this very complicated thing, right? You have the amount of energy that's transferred to large scales as a function of the non-dimensional parameter, either the Rossby number or the Froude number or both. It's a very complicated thing, and it seems to be that at this point, no existing LES.
But what is wrong with that?
Well, okay.
You don't need LES for inverse cascade. Just cut all the... What is the perfect LES for this
lesson? Yeah, no, I mean, it's only if you want to resolve even less scales than I'm doing here, right?
But in the LES, you don't resolve them. That's the trick. The trick is you put the force on your mesh side and see what happens on large scale.
Right. No, but I mean, in the ocean, in the atmosphere, I guess the question is, where is the real forcing, and can you resolve below that?
Just on the forcing. The flux is constant, so nothing depends on where you put the forcing.
Well, the flux is not necessarily constant in this range.
How can it be not constant? No viscosity, no force.
It's time dependent. So the flux is
time dependent. The smaller scale, the integral scale, everything is stable.
Yes. Well.
Having to be pushed to beyond the waters is somehow the statement that the transfer is dominated by many, many successive trials.
Probably.
Rather than just sort of a two-step process, which you described at some point, where you first dump near and then that is your. But somehow you can imagine that there's more space for these multiple step trials. Is that the?
Yeah. I mean, do you
want to
comment,
Wally?
Oh, yeah. That's
so. Is that the case for mobilization group?
But I think the quartets, the phase space of four wave interaction is much bigger. But what let's show is if the omega in the spectrum is constant, plus minus one, so three waves cannot lead to the resonance. Absolutely not. So only a limited number of waves can satisfy. Right. So the fourth order interaction is much more, from this point of view, is much more efficient. And moreover, the fourth order interaction automatically immediately leads to the inverse cascade because of the wave conservation. That's what we show.
So, yeah, but you would have to show, right, that you get these vortices or these layers in some sort of a model where you leave out whatever, right? And you just have a subset of interactions.
But the direct path of inverse escape in this system comes very nicely simply from the four wave interactions.
So it's indeed the case of two conservation logs, right? Approximately.
Absolutely right. But the remarkable thing here is that because of the distortion relation is basically constant, it's scale independent, the spectrum corresponding to the conserved waves. And the spectrum corresponding to energy flux are identical because omega of k is constant.
But does the dynamics show a difference for the three-wave interactions or four-wave interactions? Both are admissible in it? Both are admissible?
Yes. Yeah. It's just that, I mean.
You can find them.
Well, you know, it's a question. I mean, we have triads, right? In our system,
yeah.
You
yeah.
can think of a quartet as two successive triads, right? Okay.
Because you know, some dispersion relations don't allow either 3D. I mean,
yeah, I understand.
Three,
yeah. No. Yeah. There are definitely resonant triads. If that's what you're asking.
Oh yeah.
To
okay. But the
the structural information may be extended with the Yarko effect. The Yarko effect is something like a.
I suggest to continue in private. Let's say it's going to be
Thursday.
The next item on the menu is special food salad.
First of all, First of all, I want to thank Boris Raymond for the opportunity to give the talk here. And I'm going to speak of particle clusterization and turbulence. This work was done in collaboration with Evgeny Balkovsky and Grisha Parkovich. Both of them are now in the audience. And I'm going to speak about the phenomenon which is to some extent familiar to everyone. Observing particles immersed into random flow, one easily sees that they usually form some kind of clusters that possess clusterization property. Examples of this is for example, cloud formation in the atmosphere, or clusters formed by dirt on the surface of the water. And so I'm going to speak about the theory of this phenomenon. Let me first sketch plan of my talk. First, I'm going to show that that velocity which attracts the particle is compressible, and in turbulent case it must be considered as random. Then I'll show that if one disregards Brownian motion of particles, then the situation is unstable, and one could call it dynamo, in the sense that the moments of particle concentration grow exponentially. And after one accounts for the diffusion, steady state results, which nevertheless possesses parametrically large moments, parametrically by Schmidt number and Reynolds number, which I will define in a moment. And this means strong intermittency of particle distribution in a random flow. And I want to say from the very beginning that all the consideration is going to be passive, in the sense that you consider the case when one can neglect back reaction of particles on the flow. And so let me start.
So a lot of this would apply to passive scalars?
No.
Pardon?
It's non-buoyant particles.
Yeah. I'm speaking about inertial particles. So,
before
I start discussing particles, let me consider a single particle. A single particle in the flow, where U is the velocity of the fluid. I will designate the position of the particle by Y and its velocity by V. Then the usual situation is that Reynolds number related to the motion of particle through the fluid is small, so that the force which acts on the particle is just Stokes' gap force. And here, for simplicity, I consider the case when one can neglect Eddy's mass signals, but that is, density of the particle is much larger than fluid density, and one can easily generalize. So, the situation in the case when Stokes' tau s, which is Stokes' rotation time, the particle adjusts itself to follow the flow. This time I will assume to be much smaller than the smallest characteristic time of the fluid flow, which for turbulence is just the eddy turnover time of smallest edges of Kolmogorov scale, of Kolmogorov dissipation scale. And in that case, one can solve this system perturbatively in this parameter and find that the following result. That the velocity of particles is to the lowest order, of course, given just by the fluid velocity of this point. But nevertheless, there are, of course, corrections of this form.
So, is it possible to make it flow like that? How this is actually much smaller than tau p?
Yeah.
So, I mean, a really turbulent flow, like, say, Orlando 1000.
Make the mass smaller.
Yeah.
Pardon me?
Make the mass smaller.
Tau s is estimated as, well, if this is square of particle size divided by this
right, so there's no mass. So
and ratio of particle density for the density of the fluid. And
almost you just measure it and then you can.
So this is the unit measure and you can do it. So
is that an additive term have much of an effect?
Pardon?
Is that a higher order term have much of an effect?
No, the rate. This is small correction.
No, the second term, the one after the velocity, that one. Does that have much of
this one?
Yeah.
This is usually small because this right. is compared
so,
to the ratio.
So it's almost passive then?
Yes, it's almost passive, and what I'm going to show that even though this compressibility is practically small, it can lead to dramatic.
But even the density ratio is 1, right? If the same density is to the a square root, so the particle size has to be tinier. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, these are small,
the
these are small particles,
which
are
smaller
yes.
than
particles.
A power plane.
Yes.
So these are traces, these are non-mean particles.
Almost traces.
Oh.
Just almost
why do I ask this question? Because we measured this, right? And our particles are Kolmogorov size particles, and we think we're not in that limit. That's why I'm asking that question.
What is the density ratio of your part?
It's 1. It's the same. Okay. We have investigated density, and we find out there's a very strong size. If you go to 10 Kolmogorov size,
so that one sees that it is possible to define effective velocity for the particles, describing their motion. And the important fact about this velocity is that its divergence is not equal to zero generally, and even if the fluid itself is incompressible. So that the problem which we must consider to describe the distribution of such particles when there are lots of them and neglecting the interaction between them is to introduce macroscopic velocity field for them. And then they will satisfy the usual convention diffusion type equation where kappa is diffusion coefficient accounting for the Brownian motion executed by particles. To show that compressibility can have dramatic effects, let me start from the from first disregarding the diffusion.
There's no friction force between particle and water?
This is Stokes force. This is in the equations which I started from.
That's the model of the friction force.
So
the
Stokes then? Yes. This
is squared over here.
The diffusion of particles is usually small, so that Schmidt number, which is the ratio of fluid viscosity, so diffusion coefficient is much larger than unity. And as I'll show, during long initial stage of evolution, one can't really neglect Brownian motion and consider the fluid as ideal, and ideal in the sense of no diffusion. And this was, the corresponding analysis was done for Krashner model, which is decorrelated in time velocity. It was done by Krashner and Gurai. And here I'll show that they found exponential growth of the moments of density. And here I'll show that the situation is general. So in Lagrangian frame, the equation satisfied by particle concentration can be easily resolved to give this solution. And since in turbulence, this process must be considered as a random with a finite correlation time, which is which can be estimated as added turnover time of smaller stages of the flow. At times much larger than the correlation time of this process, distributions of such variables can be described universally, so that we are able to deal with any statistics of turbulence in this case. And the distribution is given by, can be summarized by the entropy function, so that at time t much larger than the correlation time of this process, one has this form of the distribution. And this general form is enough usually to get all the physically interesting conclusions about the flow. Let me show that how this form leads to exponential growth of the moments of density. First of all, this analysis the previous analysis was done in Lagrangian frame. And to pass to Eulerian average, one should weight every Lagrangian trajectory by its volume, which is proportional to the inverse density. So that one can establish this formula for the average of alpha moment in the Eulerian frame. One can translate it into the average in Lagrangian frame, which is given by this expression. And in writing this expression, I of course already assume that time is large. And again, by this ratio of time, one can evaluate this integral by saddle point approximation, which immediately leads to the conclusion that the saddle point scales with the time linearly. And substituting this into the integral, we find that one can define the function gamma alpha, which will characterize the growth of the moments. And of course, the form, precise form of this function is dependent on the velocity statistics. Nevertheless, the general demand which must be satisfied by it is that it must be convex due to Hölder inequality satisfied by the moment. And next, we know that average density must be conserved, so that it has two zeros at 0 and 1. And then it has the general generic form which it has in such a case is like this. For example, in the Kreisen model, the entropy function introduced before, distribution of this variable x is just Gaussian because correlation time tends to 0. And in that case, when the distribution is Gaussian, for example, this function turns out to be a parabola. And generally, it's some Konitz function, but we observe that moments of the order higher than unity and negative moments of density, they all grow exponentially. And this conclusion is absolutely general and relies essentially on one fact which I use, which is finite correlation time of the divergence of velocity which attacks the particle. And one can draw some interesting conclusions from this fact, such as, for example, if one considers, one follows fluid volume of fluid particle, and considers the limit at infinite time of logarithm of this volume divided by time, then one can show that for every realization, there is no average here, it's not needed. This is equal to due to gravity. This is equal to sum of Lyapunov exponents, and they are always for general compressible flow. They are smaller than unity. They are negative. Another conclusion which one gets is that density decays almost everywhere for every realization of velocity, which taken into account together with the fact that average density is conserved, it clearly indicates that intermittency of the distribution of particle grows. And let me show on a more let me show how this situation arises in more physical terms. I will assume uniform initial density without any loss of generality. One can show that this is sufficient to consider such initial condition. And I will consider in parallel both the typical evolution of density field, of particle density field, and how one finds actual concentration at the point. So what happens to the density field, which is uniform initially, is that first clusters of size of the viscous scale RV of turbulence form are formed. And then they start to get compressed. And at small diffusion, there is a very long time which I will characterize after a little bit later, when they just compress as with in the case of kappa equal to zero. And then one, actually, the divergence of velocity is just a constant of this viscous scale, which means that one in a very coherent manner contracts volume, producing compressed, highly compressed regions of density in the space. And another complementary view of this process is as follows. Suppose we wish to find at some point space time t the density. What we must do? We must consider infinitesimal volume around this point, and then let it evolve along Lagrangian trajectories to the initial moment to see how many particles are picked by this infinitesimal volume. So that the density is just given by the ratio of this volume, and it is very well known that such volumes evolve in an exponential manner as long as their size is smaller than the viscous scale of velocity. So that this situation may be interpreted as instability with respect to allowing to probe configurations which do not preserve the volume of the particle. That is, as long as velocity is compressible, these volumes just are conserved. After we allow the compressibility, these are precisely the configurations which determine the moments of the density. And from this picture, one can all expect that eventually, since the mechanism of this process is very simple, it just produces compressed regions of density in space, one can expect that final diffusion will eventually stop this process. And let me show that this is indeed the case with some qualifications. So the dynamical picture of evolution was as follows, that regions get compressed up to a scale at which diffusion will eventually balance contraction of the regions by velocity. And as we go from these clusters evolve from the scale which is viscous scale of turbulence to the scale which is a diffusive scale, and this evolution happens in an exponential manner, we conclude that the time of this evolution can be estimated as logarithm of this ratio, which is nothing but logarithm of Schmidt number, which is large, as I said before. So that indeed there is a long period of a long stage of evolution where the analysis with kappa equal to zero applies. Mm. So then, as long as we reach these times, there are two situations to be considered. First, if Reynolds number is of the order of one, then actually what happens is that diffusion just stops its compression, and there is a dynamical balance between diffusion, which tries to smoothen the distribution of particles, and velocity, which, as we know, produces these clashes. And then moments just saturate at some time, which is in fact by itself function of the moment considered. And the saturated moments in this case are large by Schmidt number. And so in this picture, it corresponds to the volumes let me now again show this, how one finds the density with diffusion, just passing from the dynamical picture of evolution of density field to actual recipe how to find the density. So diffusion introduces smallest scale into the problem, which is the diffusive scale. And then one can show that the only change which one must do in the previous description, taking infinitesimal volume and letting it evolve till the initial moment of time, is that now this volume must be taken as having finite size, which is the diffusive scale. Then again, as long as the size of this volume which evolves is smaller than the viscous scale, it evolves just in the same manner as an infinitesimal volume, and one gets again the result of kappa equal to zero, which is exponential growth of the moment. As long as this scale is reached, the velocity field, if Reynolds number is of the order 1, the velocity field becomes by itself becomes of diffusive nature, and then the growth is stopped. However, if the situation which we consider corresponds to larger Reynolds numbers, then the velocity which stretches this volume, actually there are configurations on which again this volume continues to stretch. However, the velocity field is rather now belongs to inertial interval, and the volume starts to grow in power law fashion. And its growth is precisely due to the fact that divergence of velocity acts coherently on much larger scale than the viscous scale, but it acts coherently on the integral scale of turbulence due to power law correlations in the inertial interval. And the dynamical picture which occurs at this stage of evolution is that one still continues to bring particles in a sense from the region where divergence of velocity is correlated. One continues to bring them coherently to the observation point. And this happens in the power law fashion, so that at this stage, one can characterize the evolution of the moments is characterized by another function, which is beta alpha, and it describes the scaling of the moment. To illustrate in another way how this happens, it's very illustrative to consider one-dimensional situation for which essentially the previous arguments apply as well. In this case, volume, this infinitesimal volume, is described by a single degree of freedom, which is the separation between the boundaries. And therefore, one can actually get much more insight on the situation. And that it is very much clear that it is a known fact that as long as the distance between the particles lies in the viscous interval, its moments behave exponentially, and after one comes to inertial interval of turbulence, the separation starts to behave in bow-like fashion, so that the moments indeed behave in such a way. And again, this function beta alpha depends by itself on the statistics of velocity. However, satisfying again the general demands of convexity and being equal to zero, both at zero and unit. So that again, the moments of the order of, which is higher than unity continue to grow. And so this regime continues until this, let's say, reservoir of particles is exhausted. So that and again, diffusion will balance the situation, and dynamical balance will take place. The corresponding steady state, which takes place at larger times, can be exemplified by considering pair correlation function, for which one has the following general picture. At scale larger than the integral scale of turbulence, the correlation function of density separated by distance r becomes just a product of averages equal to square of average density. Then in the inertial interval of turbulence, one expects to find scaling, and the same is true in the viscous interval of turbulence until the distance are diffusive, where the correlation function saturates. So that this immediately leads to the conclusion that the value of this correlation function at zero is parametrically larger than the value, its value at large distance, which means that it differs from the average density by some power of large parameters of our problem, which is Reynolds number and Schmidt number. And this calculation, so that if one now measures by any measure, which is, for example, root mean square ratio, the fluctuations of n to the mean average, to the mean density, then it is parametrically large, indicating that we're dealing with state with very strong fluctuations. And the main characteristics of this steady state, again, may be characterized by two functions, which are beta alpha and gamma alpha. I denote them by tilde because they differ from the functions into the characterizing devolution due to the dependence of cutoff time on the order of the moment one considers. So again, so these functions satisfy the demand of convexity, and again they must be equal to zero, at zero and unit, which so that again moments of the order higher than unit in the steady state are parametrically large. And again, taking into account that the fact that average density is conserved, one concludes that particle distribution in turbulence possesses extremely strong intermittence, which can be characterized by this function. So.
Early on, what the assumption on average divergence of the.
It is that it must have a finite correlation time.
Sorry, but just average.
When you consider this. When you consider this expression, the main assertion was that you might assert this form of probability to this function. Right?
Right. But so average divergence is zero.
Average divergence is zero, which guarantees conservation of the average density.
And right, and that. And I guess that is just Laplacian pressure.
Yes, this is Laplacian of the pressure.
Right, okay.
So
continuity. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. So, Jerry, tell. This is the most important announcement that you have to make. If anyone wants to play soccer, we're going to meet at 7 at the team next week.
Thank you.
Thank you. There is the business of sedimentation. So you have these falling particles, it's a self limit, so they just affect each other with so if you measure the velocity difference spectrum, and if you try to estimate velocity difference spectrum by assuming that the point distribution is Poisson, right? So you assume, well, this is a uniform density of stuff, right?
Mm-hmm. What is point distribution?
Well, for lack of that idea.
Yeah.
Right, this is saying that
you mean
distribution
of what?
Particles. Yeah. The particles are uncorrelated.
Okay. Positions for the
positions. And their velocity are is on the left frame, the slip velocity relative to the fluid plus whatever the local velocity is. And okay, so if you do that, you will decide that what the difference, where it goes, and the difference.
Those
two different
particles.
Yeah. Right. So instead of two-thirds, you get a half. Okay.
This is around the four.
Right. Instead of two-thirds, you get one.
Right. V1 minus V2 squared proportional to R1.
Yes. Then you have a right to worry whether density is really possible. So the question, can I apply to this your logic? I would imagine that this slip velocity is quite immaterial. But I just go into a co-moving frame and co-moving with mean velocity.
Okay.
And
is it right to interpret your question as whether one can really have the infection of particles and conditions?
No.
Well, see,
this is not.
Look, I guess what I'm trying to say is, you here assume velocity as given as having some statistics, right? And then you proceed to recalculate density fluctuations. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
To the extent that the velocity field in sedimentation is also dominated by large scale, I think it is fair to ask a similar question. So suppose there is some random distribution of particles setting up some random velocity, right? And then I look at what's happening to density fluctuations in some small block, right? Most of the velocity is coming from far away, right?
Yeah.
So I can, at least for a moment, think of what's happening in a small block for passive, right? So forget about the correlation of the velocity and particles.
Yeah.
But then I think you're telling me that the particle statistics is very far from Poisson. Presumably, right, it doesn't matter what scaling your...
Yes.
I'm not sure that in sedimentation you really have a large scale around them for...
Well, I assure you that you do.
It's not like you have fluid in individual particles, or this fluid makes something like this.
Yeah, it does. But
so means...
Exactly.
Then you'll have very long Bell chance.
Yes, that's exactly what it does. If you look at the statistics, what hyperbole is.
Yeah, Poisson means that correlation functions decay to correlation, right?
Well, Poisson really means that there are no pair correlations. So one particle doesn't know where the next one is. So
this gives exponential decay of correlation function, right?
No, it means that it's delta correlated. Poisson is really delta correlated. But short range is fine.
No, the equation is not about time decay, it's about correlation.
And pair correlation function.
So
the steady state.
Yeah. Poisson means the
correlation. Yeah, but here the probability
correlates very much. Right,
and here the correlation is very much. But I think it's the same, but by dropping the line, just look, nobody has calculated particle distribution in sedimentation. Batchelor said that it's Poisson, and it's been Poisson ever since.
You want us to embrace to our theory?
No, I don't want
you
to.
But what is the problem? So, can we consider it as the problem that we already have, plus
gravity. What is that?
No, it's not going to be the problem that that you have, because you have a passive problem.
Yes,
this is going to be an active problem,
but the question is, can you cut this active problem into passive and then try to self-consist?
Why is it necessary to why can I consider to use sedimentation?
No, because all that's happening is you have particles, and they move, right, they fall with some velocity.
Uh-huh.
And then they eject each other with some velocity. And never mind, there's some tension here. So don't worry about it. Mm-hmm. Right. So that's the problem. So
there is no trouble.
But can you ask some questions that we may try?
There is some velocity field, right? There's some VI here, right? And this VI is V of RI, right? There's some VR, that is the sum now of all particles, and some tensor R. Okay.
So, is it dominated by the vicinity of the particle or by the far
particles?
The integral is divergent. So it is all sitting on large scale. That's why all of this is happening.
Yeah.
So if you look at this, right? Just plug this in and. Assuming that the particles are completely uncorrelated, that's possible. So just sit there with the condenser. Right? So you will find that. But now the question is, are they really uncorrelated? And right, there are two things that come to mind. That either they avoid each other, or they attract each other.
And of course, I can immediately answer that. Of course, they attract each other in the region where dV is negative, and they attract each other in the region where dV is positive.
On average.
No, on average, they
don't have an average.
Because
on average, dV is.
But the interaction between particles depends on the local dV of the flow. You cannot say the particle attract each other very well. It depends.
But I thought the whole point was clusterization. I thought the whole point was that there are some regions.
We're now talking about back reactions. Okay. When you ask how particle interact, is absolutely beyond the field of our work. But now I'm trying to discuss back reaction in interaction between particles.
If you forget about the origin of this field, that this is the integral of the right, it is generated by falling particles, right? But it's just some wonderful velocity field with some statistics parameterized by your entropy function or something, or whatever you want, right?
Yeah.
If I understand you correctly, then this falls straight into your universe.
You can use it.
And the answer is, and so now let me understand precisely what the answer is. So what is the answer? So what is the statement for about this object, for example?
Yes, power law correlations.
Power law correlations. So, but power law is related to this scaling.
It is in the steady state only. This object is not stationary.
is not it's time dependent. Only on very large scales.
Wait, so why?
That is the problem in which there was uniform initial distribution.
Well,
and then there appears some randomness in time, and this guy starts to evolve. And eventually it will evolve initially with unity. Okay? It is just unity. Or mean value.
Unity or zero?
No. And n is time definite. Concentration is
indefinite.
So it is n squared. Yeah. So initially it is like this.
Yeah.
What we've shown is that it evolves in time as follows. You start from this, and as time goes, it starts to develop something like this. And eventually, this something like this, and this is some situation state if there is...
where is one?
This is n as a function of r.
Where
is
one?
Time going. Here is one. So you start from this constant. This is the problem that we solved.
Sorry. One.
This is
one. One.
This is m of zero, m of r as a function of r at different t. T goes up.
Wait, I'm sorry. So I can move this?
You build and build correlation. Some short scale, that's how you build it. You start the spread relation function, initially it's constant. You may subtract this constant if you wish. Okay. So this
and
is
now
a function of.
Completely correlated.
Mm-hmm.
Completely correlated. If I
have
one part,
then
another part.
No, I mean, it's never completely correlated. You consider the relation between n of r and n of 0. And this correlation is positive. So it's and the closer r to zero, the more chance to find another particle or more particle. That's why this function is monotonically decreasing function of r any moment. Asymptotically, of course, it's always here.
Right.
And what happens
okay,
is time
really
is that you're
speaking, so
yeah,
the speed is
that we describe in this theory. And this is some situation state. And of course you are right. I mean even in most realistic situations that reaction starts much before. In a sense that this cluster may be stopped. Not by the fact that you already reach out of scale of turbulence, but it might be because the particle really interrupts. And when you ask how they interact, my answer to you is that they attract each other in the region, which expand, because their interaction
sure.
is really, they try to...
But they end up...
When they clusterize,
they don't move together
very fast,
yeah.
And that's it.
What?
Sedimentation.
Yeah.
Sedimentation, when the cluster rises,
it
starts to move very fast.
But again, because...
The
interaction is very simple. They both move together.
I mean, this is completely non-trivial. You're right. You know, it has very, very serious implications. Precisely because it means that if you
get this clustering, it means that you're getting droplets like that.
Mm-hmm.
And droplets fall much faster.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. So... the whole thing will start sedimenting
This is why I'm trying to get from you something like this. How one can use, to build a complete theory of sedimentation, one needs interactions between particle and plasma.
But the first thing is...
Let's use our theory to make the next non-trivial step.
Well, the first step...
We have our theory, which is completely passive. So. The second step might be in two directions. First, of including gravity, but still considering it passive, or by including interaction, but still not considering gravity. And actually, that's
not... there is no gravity in interaction. It's just one of the same things together.
Yeah.
Now, there is no gravity. This is it. Gravity is sitting in B together.
Yeah, all the flow is...
So,
this is
just interaction.
Gravity.
That's all.
Okay, let's...
It's just accelerating.
No,
it's not accelerating.
It's a threefold
velocity, that's all.
So if you say, okay guys, go and get interaction into your
problem.
So that's kind of stuff.
Well, it's tough. But the first step is already highly non-trivial. So if you tell me that there is
look, the fear is density, yeah?
Okay, but unfortunately...
Let's substitute our answer to some formula.
There is nothing like that. I'm pretty sure that there is nothing like that.
Where
there is nothing? It's a limitation. There is no growth of... No, because in fact...
That means that you don't have a random flow. Or that means that back reaction is much stronger than the randomness of your flow.
Well, wait.
If particle strongly interacts, strongly, which means with respect to how random flow produces this posterization, then you will see no posterization. You see particle moving like a whole lattice, together. The whole layer of particles moving together, and not the posterization. If the interaction between particles...
Is the question right? Well, I think the answer is... I guess the answer is no, because I think I know what this thing is doing. It is...
First of all, it is function...
boring things.
Yeah, but it is boring. This function is very simple. It decays in distance. The only thing, if it decays parametrically, which means that it's very here, it's parametrically larger than it's very here. Or if you subscribe this unity, then you might ask if this decay by some, power law, etc. But first of all, I'm very surprised by your statement. This limitation theorem really gives potentially random flow. Because this all fits on turbulence.
But take that. I'm telling you, they do.
So if you don't see strong peak of density correlation at short distances, that tells me that your interaction between particles much stronger than your random flow, random component of your flow, that would produce this posterization. Because interactions between particles tend to stop this posterization.
Yeah, but in fact, there is no pairwise interaction.
Multiple interactions. That's precisely what I'm saying. But interactions between particles tend to stop posterization. That's absolutely true, at least for the data.
I want to think up here. So what you're predicting is that if I start with some random Lagrangian trajectory somewhere in space, which is a particle, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then sometime later they will come together.
The Lagrangian trajectory is without everything, and what we are now telling here is different from the Lagrangian trajectories. We are telling now that if you put in your, as this was decided, I wanted to tell to talk to you, if you put in your experiments particles which are a little bit inertial, which are inertial in the sense that they a little bit retarded if they are heavier, or advanced if they are lighter with respect to the Lagrangian trajectories. This little bit of being in shell would create this absolute value. And that's what really happens to dust in the atmosphere. So if you want to model it in your system, you produce initially absolutely, say, homogeneous distribution of your particles. And then you, with your fantastic technique, you can really track it and see how you create these clusters of particles. But particles should be non-biased. That means that they should move differently from velocity. They move a little bit because they are very tiny. But still, because their density is not equal to the density of the fluid, they would move a little bit differently.
Well, that's easy to do.
That's easier to do than to put...
When I look at the time scales, we are... The Stokes time in our case... So
give me the size of your particle, give me the density of your particle, and it will give you the time scale for this fertilization. Because independent...
But the time scale separation that you assume is not with other particles.
What do you mean?
But our parties typically, we measure accelerations, right?
Yeah.
We measure the acceleration correlation functions about 1 kilometer.
About what?
About 2 kilometer. So there's been the correlation of the acceleration changes in roughly 2 kilometer.
That's precisely the great power of the
what happens in the Lagrangian, right?
Yeah.
Now the when I take our particular particle size, which is 40 microns, I get that the Stokes sign is approximately larger than how you do it.
We need particle less, which is smaller size.
Well, which is very small. So this is already a 50. You know, our common wavelength plane. You need particles which are much much smaller. Which in our field means that you use 1 micron particles.
Which is very, very typical in atmosphere.
Which is tough. To get up high Reynolds number, you know.
Still, I mean, it's less dramatic, but again, we have a prediction that if you put particles, we have
typical. I mean, you could put it. I'm just trying to figure that out. So what is your prediction again? I mean, I didn't quite get the prediction.
Okay, what I would do is the tail name, right?
So just say, well, you tell me it's clustering, right? So I go in there and throw in. And I make, let's say, I choose some type of composite setup because I'm clever. I say my great experiment. So I take some fluorescent dyes that, let's say, which sort of glow, you know, when I shine light on. And so let's say I just take a laser beam. Let's say just assume I take a laser beam to my experiment. And I have a little line in that relatively high density of cells, you know. Which is 1 micron fluorescent sphere. And then I just image this line. On that line, I would find it's clustering, I would find very strong lines of variation on that line. Now, the question is, what should I measure on that line to compare? Is there anything I can learn from it?
Just a histogram of density.
That would be good enough. Well, that's a simple experiment, too. But this fluorescent particle, you know, you can get fluorescent particles which are very highly fluorescent, which are 1 micron, 0.1 micron. So that would be 0.1 micron, 14 micron flow, I'm up by a factor of 100. Now this condition is fulfilled. This condition is
fulfilled. In a way, I mean, well, according to this ratio comes like technically, but again, I think that anything related to quantitative comparison with the series is more important.
So what you're saying is, I get it.
What I'm saying is that if you can see the temporal evolution, if you can really see how it initially came to life.
But my question now was, I can't see the temporal one because I see is one spatial picture.
You may consider it
as but then you have to be very angular.
What I'm saying is that, let's say, that you initially have a uniform distribution of the neurons. You just choose. You didn't
have that experimentally. Because you just tell me it's clustering, so how can I mix?
Wait. Let's say you don't have two, but you just don't have any four. You just have uniform distribution. You make a line, you see that it's distributed along the line, or it's uniform with some small
group. You don't agree to the line because it's breaking my hair.
Then you start to move. Mm-hmm. And you can monitor or measure from time to time, I don't know, for the experimentally better, still the distribution of and then you see how this fluctuation of your concentration change along this line. And what I predict is that it will change in an exponential pattern, in the sense that there is a second moment, just n minus n average square, will grow exponentially for some time, which is just the time grows exponentially proportional to the Reynolds number, as it's stated. Again, I don't think that you have very high Reynolds number. I don't think that you don't have much of an exponential law
to measure exponential time.
Huh?
What does that mean? I mean, how long does it take for this exponential formula. What is
it? It's some power of Reynolds number. This you can populate
the quantitative numbers. But it's observable.
Wait.
You see, it could be instantaneous in terms of experimental measurement techniques.
Give me what I need for this is the typical the size of the particle, the density of the particle, and the temperature. If you give me the fusion, the fusivity of your particle, it would be.
Well, I can give you the particle size, I can give you all these numbers.
Yeah. What I really need, I need to use the particles, just know what time. Yeah, each depends on the temperature of the medium and particle size. So the moment I know really the time scale of the crystallization phenomenon is proportional to the time scale of proportional to the turnover time of the viscous scale, and some not quite trivial function of particle size its diffusivity and viscosity. By the way, that would be also very interesting for us, because so far our series, all letters and all numbers, now we're talking about some numbers for realistic situation. But again, just from everyday experience, you know, when I, you know, mix tea or I see in the bath or I see the scale, I just see how, I mean, they all go inside the vortex, and it's visible. I just
think. Well, the vortex, but that's...
I mean, people use flow visualization with small metallic particles, that's precisely the crystallization that we described. We just make statistical theories.
No, they use the anisotropy, they try to visualize the shear.
But that's precisely what we're doing. I mean, locally, if you have inhomogeneous flow, then the fact that heavy particles go outside vortices and light particles go inside the vortices, it is a basic elementary act of the phenomenon of crystallization that we described. It's a very old, a well-known phenomenon on the level of elementary act. Just nobody before understood that those elementary acts put it together in turbulence would produce this exponential and then power law growth of fluctuation. Which, when you see it, is absolutely.
Well, we should put in the time. I mean, you know, if the time scale is bad, we should be able to calculate what the time scale is.
Yeah, again, if it might just be
totally unreasonable.
If the time scale is too short, that's fine. Because then you can just measure a steady distribution and then find how intermittent it is, what is this probability distribution, that the moments are really large, in a sense that you increase the Reynolds number of your flow,
people have done that?
No! People never got theory about it. People never did.
Did you measure that?
No. It's hard to believe. People use inertial particles for visualization probably 70 years or maybe 100 years.
But you were using it.
But nobody thought about statistics of this. At least,
but why? They can be densely matched. It still happens, right? The particles can be densely matched. That's what I don't understand. I mean, you need a difference density.
Yeah, which is much easier than to have particles of the same density.
I know, but the natural one is that they are different.
Yeah, and that's what, I mean, you look at a small metallic particle in the flow, and you realize...
It's very different. Density is very different.
Then density is very different, but our theory is for any density. Density may be 1,000 times larger, 1,000 times smaller, I mean, that's all the same problem.
We would have to use the resonance of the Reynolds. See, the problem is with my experiment, the only resonance is the Reynolds. The resonance is difficult,
shadowing.
The nice thing is the resonance, you get a little more light scattering around the particles. But hopefully the attenuation down the line is not too much.
If you're telling me that the particle density is different from density, how much it is?
It's 1.06.
That's the worst situation, but it's almost close to unity.
Of course, we try to get
the right. It makes this whole crystallization very slow.
You can take your guess. I mean, you could put in
It's actually proportional, which means that it will be the aluminum powder. It will be at least 20 viscous turnover time.
But you want to make it wrong.
No,
the longer the to us for the experiment.
If you want to
know
how it's the built-in of the
right, the longer the better.
Yeah.
Because we can, you know, turnover time is typically one rotation rate of our system.
Yeah.
Which is about, we rotate this experiment at 9 hertz.
So
the turnover time is very short.
So maybe it is just good.
So we want to have a long, so in other words, you want to go to the long limit. You want to get everything so that the time is really large. The longer the better.
There is another problem. It's really theory is neglecting the interaction with the different particles. Which is really assuming that because those particles are very dilute. And I can write precise criteria of what I mean. If I'll take concentration of the particle and multiply it not by a cube of particle size, but I take n, multiply it by a, and by square root of these two things. See, it comes, but I can hear that So normally to say faster in particle dilute is to say this. Much less. I don't want this. I want much more. Actually, I want this.
Right.
It is a viscous scale. Every particle has a very viscous flow around it.
You don't want it.
It's a Stokes flow. So every particle
has a
variation
like this.
And every other particle feels this modification of the flow. So if I want to calculate the interaction between the particle, I have to integrate this in my three-dimensional space. And this integral is divergent of large distances as r squared. But cutoff for it is viscous scale. This integral behaves like this.
So
and it should be much less easy. Then I may neglect an interruption. So it imposes this condition on your density. Otherwise,
it would be kept. So let's say A is micron. Eta is, let's say we take a R lambda of about 400 or something. So Eta is about 50 microns.
Yeah.
50 microns, so
yeah.
We have 1 times 50 squared, right? So it's 2,500 microns cubed.
It's
okay.
1 per 1 of these. Well, this is very heavy. That's actually okay. So this is
if it condenses, it's supposed to be lower.
That's not a very low density. I mean, this is.
That's
a very similar
thing,
right?
We don't need.
Oh no, it's 2 times 5 times 3.
That number to be large.
Yeah, it's really n less.
One part of the
four.
We don't need to be large.
Four.
Can be small gravity.
So if you want in a meter, then you multiply it 10 to 18, so it gets 10 to 18. It's absolutely widespread.
What we should do is we should sit down. We write down all the numbers. So we conclude this can be measured.
I'll leave on Sunday for a week. How long will you be here?
Well, I'm leaving Sunday for a week, Saturday for a week.
You know, that they will get better.
Yeah.
When you
have rivers.
Okay. And so I remember today is Tuesday. Monday will pass Friday. All after the
Because
I come back on 20 and stay until 29.
Maybe. Right, I come back 15, I think that's 29. My time towards the end is eaten up by preparations for using the drive back. Taking back a car, sell furniture, useless things. Oh yeah, I'm a medical, so we first Santa Barbara, and now we have to sell a lot of furniture. Making the cars more into the drive back.
So do we go up on
So what we have done, we have made an Excel meeting, it's part of the size of Excel which is something that is a problem. So what we have measured is how particle size and particle density act on the acceleration. On the acceleration variance,
the
margin acceleration variance, just acceleration variance.
Assume that the particle
just fall over that. Oh, no, it's just experimental. So what we say is we measure the pressure gradient by putting in little particles. So the acceleration on the particle, it's only measured by the particle zero. And increase the particle size.
The particle size means that
by taking the chance,
the region where you average this over, or what means the particle size?
Well, the really particle size, yes.
Which means that you take particle and you
follow the particle.
And then the particle size increases, then the.
They don't follow this. But the accelerations go way down.
The high fluctuation of acceleration go way down. How it scales with the size.
The student writing here right now writing a paper. He actually wants to make more measurements for particle size effects because he has right now only one Reynolds number.
But actually, what we're doing is it's about this Lagrangian equation.
What's that?
It's all useful.
Yeah, I think I
want to know
this. We have a thesis, so there will be a write-up. We have, we're going to finish the paper.
Thank you. Thank you.